Good afternoon. Rabbi Day isn't here today, so I am here to introduce Shuli Mishkin. Of course, she needs very little introduction. We are going to be continuing today and visiting Tzfat. So I'm sure many of us have visited before, but you know, it'll be nice to have a bit of a different look at it today, you know, going back and looking at the sites with the texts. Of course, looking here, it looks like we're going to be going all the way back, talking about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, up to, you know, of course, people in the Middle Ages, the Ari, of course, Rabbi Yosef Karo, etc. So I'm looking forward, and take it away, Shuli.
Hey, thank you, Maxine. Okay, so let's get started. Hi, everybody. So we have a little bit, we're going to do something a little different than what we've been doing till now. Till now, we've been doing very, very text-based. Today is a little bit more kind of atmospheric because that's kind of Tzfat. And also because, first of all, the really in-depth Kabbalistic writings, as I mentioned last week, I'm not a philosopher. I am also not a Kabbalist. And second, the main character we're going to talk about today, the Ari, Rav Yitzchak Luria, did not leave a lot of writings behind. What we know about him, what we know about his philosophy and his life story, we know much more from his student, particularly Rav Chaim Vital. So we don't have a lot of primary sources of the Ari himself. But let's just get started. The Stairway to Heaven, I will explain in a minute. But this class today is very much a transition from what we've been doing up until now. Okay. Rather that we're, first of all, moving into a new era in terms of rulers of the land of Israel. Okay. If up until now, we were talking about the early Muslims, the Crusaders, the Mamluks. We are now moving into the, I guess we'll call it the pre-modern period. We're going to talk about the Ottoman Empire, which starts out with great, great promise in the land of Israel and ends with great disappointment, but that's not in the scope of our course. So that's one transition. Another transition, if up until now we have been talking about Spanish Jews, about the Ramban and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam, but we were also talking about Ashkenazim who are making their way to the land of Israel and the Aliyah of the 300 rabbis, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. Today we're really going to be talking less about Ashkenazim, certainly less about Jews who have lived in Eretz Yisrael, right? What we'll call, for lack of a better term, native Jews, and more transitioning to Jews coming from Spain, coming from Portugal. It's a different kind of population. What are they bringing with them, both in a positive and a negative sense? If up until now, we've largely been on the coast or in Jerusalem, in Tveria, today we're going into the mountains, into the Galilee, and the area of Tzfat and around Tzfat. Everybody who's not muted, please mute themselves, or maybe Maxine, mute everybody, not me. If last time we really talked about the Rambam and rationalism and Greek philosophy and kind of leaving behind any very, again, for lack of a better word, supernatural way of looking at Judaism. Today we are diving into the mystics. And next time we're going to be going into messianism, false as well as true. So this is very much a transition. What is fascinating about Tzfat in the 16th century, the golden age of Tzfat, is that we are really talking about an incredibly short period of time, maybe 50 to 75 years. We're talking about a very small group of people, right? A core group of people, a few thousand people at the very most, and yet they impact on Judaism, I would say definitely till today, but certainly in those early, you know, the first few centuries afterwards, whether it was the Messianism and Shabtai Tzvi that we're going to be talking about, or later in Hasidut, the ideas that come out of this very short and limited period in Tzfat impact on Judaism for for centuries and still impact on us today. So that's really what we're going to try to explore. The picture is just a classic spot picture, both in the sense of like going up and a staircase and where we're always trying to ascend higher and higher, but also the blue, right? Anybody who's been to Spot or has seen any of the incredibly beautiful pictures that people take of Spot, people love to take pictures in Spot. You see blue all over the place, right? Blue doorways, blue windows, blue stairs, a lot of blue. What's going on with the blue? So some people take a short-sighted view and they say, well, blue, you know, Arabs also make things blue and it's against the evil eye, blah, blah, blah. But really, that's not the issue. It's a much, much older idea. The blue goes back to the Talmud and it goes back to the Torah, right? Where do we have blue in the Torah? We have the idea of tchelet, right? This beautiful blue that is meant to be one string of your ritual fringes of your tzitzit is supposed to be a p'til tchelet, is this blue color, you know, and the way we dye it was lost, has now been refound. That's less important to us today. But the Gemara says, well, why blue? Right? Why blue? You could pick any color in the world. Why does God want us to put blue on tzitzit? And the Gemara says, very beautiful, right? The Gemara in Menachot, the blue reminds us of the sea. The sea reminds us of the sky. The sky reminds us of Kisei HaKavod, right? Of God's heavenly presence. So blue is meant to always be bringing your gaze to a more celestial realm. And that's really what's going on in Spot. We're trying to move ourselves from earth into the heavens. So let's see what we're talking about. So we're going to do actually two timelines today because we are so special. First, we want to get kind of a larger timeline of what's going on in the world. And then we're going to talk about specific people in Spot and how do they fit into the timing that we're talking about. So really what we want to notice here are two different things that are going on, two different dynamics that are happening here. Okay. Number one is the transition from the Mamluks to the Ottomans. Okay. Both of them Muslims, but very different. Okay. The other one is going on not in the land of Israel, but in Europe. And that's the expulsion from Spain and then the forced conversion of the Jews in Portugal. Right. And that's very much a part of our story, even though it's happening far away from Spot, but it's the catalyst for much of our story. So that's why we have kind of a very widespread assortment of dates here, right? The Mamluks take Spot, the Mamluk ruler Baibars, if you remember way, way back to the very first class, right? He conquers Spot, he builds up Spot, and we're going to see that laying the foundations for Spot as a strong and stable city, as an economic powerhouse, that's going to be one of the reasons why Jews start coming to Spot, okay? We'll skip over the story of the Jews in Spain for a moment, just to kind of finish our trajectory of Mamluks to Ottomans. The Ottomans, who we're going to see, Turkish Muslim tribes who start to expand their empire from their very, very small base in Turkey and start to grow stronger and stronger. 11th century, 12th century, 13th century, 14th. By the 15th century, they have managed to take Constantinople, which then becomes Istanbul. Okay, they rename it. This is huge because it means they have now taken the Byzantine Empire, right? The last vestiges of Christian power in the Middle East, or really an empire, a Christian empire in the Middle East, let's put it that way. Okay. They take Constantinople, and this is an enormous thing. They have not yet taken the areas of the Mamluks, Syria, Egypt, the land of Israel, but this is part of their really push towards world domination. We're going to see in the map that they make it all the way to Europe. And skip again a little bit. And in 1517, the Ottomans take the land of Israel from the Mamluks, right? So we have this transition of power. How much does it impact on the Jews, Muslims, these Muslims, that Muslims? It does impact because the Mamluks are, by this point, kind of falling apart, corrupt, right? The end of an empire. Whereas the Ottomans come in with much more renewed strength and stability, and they want the Jews. And we'll come back to that. And then, of course, we have the very, very famous walls of Jerusalem. Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent rebuilds the walls of Jerusalem in 1538. Let's go back to our other story, right? The last time we heard about the Jews in Spain, they were thriving with some problems here and there, right? With some fanatic Muslims here and there, with the disputation and the church here and there, but mostly a golden age. But that comes to a very crashing close at the end of the 14th century, 1391. There have been events before this, but in 1391, you have massacres of the Jews, various places in Spain and Castile and Aragon, and it kind of opens up the way for a century, really a full century, of the Jews being converting, forced to convert, the Inquisition, right? All the terrible stories that we are unfortunately familiar with, culminating with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. And this is a very important thing. If you recall, we talked about Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and we talked about the Ramban. We talked about why is Spain different? Why is Spain unique among the countries of Europe in that the Jews were really able to thrive there? And part of the reason for that was because Spain was always split, or not always, but for centuries, was split between Christians and Muslims. And that put the Jews in a unique and actually very favorable position, right? That they were able to be go-betweens, that everybody wanted them, that if they were uncomfortable in one place, they could go to the other. By the end of the 15th century, right, the Spanish Christian kings and queen, right? We're talking about Ferdinand and Isabella here, finally push the last Muslims out of Spain. And at that point, mostly Isabella, she's the very devout Catholic, although Ferdinand definitely goes along with her, says, well, we've gotten rid of those heretics, let's get rid of the other ones, right? Now, this is not in, this is not good for Spain, right? And in fact, up until the expulsion, the Secretary of the Treasury of Ferdinand and Isabella is Don Yitzhak Abarbanel, right? He's a very prominent Jew. And he is the one who's bankrolling all sorts of things. And he even comes to Ferdinand and Isabella and he offers them a large sum of money so that the Jews will not be expelled. But the religious fanaticism overcomes everything. We even have a story about how, you know, Ferdinand is kind of wavering. Should he take the money from Abarbanel? Torquemada, right? The church official comes in and he says, would you sell your savior for 30 pieces of silver, right? Obviously connecting back to the story of Jesus and Judas Iscariot. So the Jews are forced out of Spain, and we'll come back to that in a few minutes. And it's not good for Spain, and it's very much not good for the Jews. Many Jews make their way to the neighboring country of Portugal because they're allowed to live there still freely, except that 5 years later, they're not even offered the choice of leaving or converting, and they are forced to convert. And that's going to be part of the story we're going to tell next week about Dona Gracia. The last thing in the timeline that's important, Spot is plagued by earthquakes, many, many, many earthquakes. And it's one of the reasons that a lot of the places we are going to see are rebuilt. They are not from the golden age of Spot. Some of them will be, and I'm going to point those out to you. But be aware that we have a major earthquake in the 18th century, and we have the last really major earthquake. It's 1837, where much of Spot is destroyed. So that's just important to understand in terms of what you see in Spot and what is historical. Okay, Yofi. We'll come back to our timelines, but let's understand a little bit of these Ottomans and who they are and where they come from. And it's truly astounding to see how far their empire spread at its greatest height, right? So they start out Turkish Muslim tribes, this really rather small, this is a great map stolen from Encyclopedia Britannica, very worth looking at. And, you know, if you want to have it later to look at again, they managed to expand, and they are expanding first kind of very locally and then moving out to take in more of the areas of Turkey, right? But also making their way all the way deep into the heart of what's left of the Byzantine Empire until ultimately taking Constantinople, taking Istanbul, like we said, moving on. And this is Sultan Mehmed II. Is a very, very powerful ruler. He is the one who expands here. And then later on, in the time of Selim the First, they expand into the whole area controlled by the Mamluks. That's this whole nice green area of Egypt, of Syria, of the land of Israel. Later they take even more. And ultimately they make it almost all the way to Vienna. Right. Look at how far their empire extends. So they are really a vast and very, very powerful empire. What's important for us is the fact that they, A, take the land of Israel. Okay, so that's Jews see that and they say, remember, we've been saying this all along. Jews see great empires fighting over the land of Israel. Ah, that's a sign of the redemption. But it's not only that. There's a very practical thing. Jews who are expelled from Spain need a place to go. We're going to look at a map in a moment of where they go. The Ottomans, who are expanding into these vast new areas that they want to cultivate and they want to enrich and they want them to be successful, Jews are very useful, right? Jews are good merchants, they're good bankers, they're artisans. There are even those who suggest that the Jews are the ones who brought gunpowder to the Ottoman Empire, right? So Jews are very useful. And when the Spaniards are throwing them out, the Turks are saying, well, hold on, what's the matter with you people? These are good people. We want them, right? We welcome them. And they're giving them a lot of religious freedom and autonomy, obviously within the, you know, the strictures of Islam, but they're still getting a lot more freedom than they would have gotten in any Christian country. So it's important to understand this backdrop of the expansion of the Ottoman Empire. And here's where we have also the Jews, right? Where are the Jews going to go? So the black arrows are later migrations, and that's where you see them going into areas of Western Europe. Why don't they go there from the beginning? Because most of Western Europe by 1492 is closed to Jews. Hey, the Jews have been expelled. They've been expelled from France and they've been expelled from Germany. Nobody wants the Jews. So Western Europe, except for Portugal, right? And then that closes down very soon as well, is mostly closed off to Jews. Now, what happens in this expulsion? And we're not going to talk too much about the expulsion, but it really is an incredibly, incredibly traumatic event. Unfortunately, Jewish history is full of so many traumatic events that sometimes we erase the earlier ones, and the Holocaust, of course, trumps everything else. But you have to really recognize the terrible crisis, physical as well as spiritual, of the expulsion of the Jews of Spain. Here is a community that, even though they had been suffering for the last century, even so, this is a community that is the most successful diaspora community until we get to the Jews of North America, okay? And we saw this in previous classes. Jews reach the pinnacle in every arena, whether it's politics or economics or culture or even the military in Muslim Spain, and they go from these incredible heights to the incredible low. So besides all the terrible physical consequences, and not to downplay that at all, right? But besides all the terrible physical consequences of the expulsion, there's a crisis of spirituality, of faith. How could this happen to us? How could this happen to us? And the Spanish Jews are very, very proud. They see themselves as descendants of the tribe of Judah. They see themselves as the elite of the Jewish world. How could this happen to us? And we have various works that talk about this and talk about what were our sins and what did we do wrong. Remember, we're in a pre-modern era. When disaster happens, what do? We say two things, right? One is, what were our sins and how can we atone for them? And that we'll talk about a little more in next week's class. And we also say, well, clearly, just like a woman has to go through labor in order to produce a child, a nation has to go through terrible crises in order to reach the redemption. So those are our two kind of focal points. How did we sin? And are we on the way to redemption? And those are really two very big ideas. Somebody said the most successful Jewish community is Israel. I'm talking about diaspora communities. Of course, Israel is the most successful Jewish community. Come on. That's why you all have to come. Now, but let's go back to what we're talking about. So we have this spiritual crisis. We also have a physical crisis, right? Historians don't know about, nobody knows exact numbers, but the rough estimate is that of the Jews of Spain, a third of them emigrate, a third of them become what we call conversos or Marranos, which is a much more derogatory term, right? They become hidden secret Jews, and a third of them die, whether it's at the hands of the Inquisition or it's in attempting to leave, right? We have these terrible situations. They're described, right? These scenes of Jews describing trying to get on overcrowded boats, right? And again, not to be too anachronistic, but Holocaust comparisons are kind of inevitable. Going to places where there's plague, where there's disease, where there's nothing to eat, where nobody wants them, right? So a third emigrate, a third convert a third die, this is a huge disaster for the community. The impact of the conversos, these hidden Jews, right? And everyone has heard stories about, you know, people who ultimately ended up in Mexico or in New Mexico or in all different kinds of places in South America, keeping these traditions alive from their great, 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 great grandmothers of lighting candles in the basement, right? But very much going underground. And today there's more of an awareness and they're starting to learn more about who they are, but it's a huge blow to the Jewish community. But where do they go, right? Where are you going to go? So as you can see from the map, you can go to Italy. Parts of Italy are still free, free to Jews, I mean. Italy is interesting because it's decentralized, it's broken up, it's a lot of different city-states, some of which want Jews, some of which don't want Jews, some of which expel their Jews eventually. So it's kind of a more open and possible area. They go to North Africa. They go to, and this is an interesting one, they go to Eastern Europe, right? Which is another kind of a similar story. Frontier. We're just starting these new places, these new cities, and Jews are really useful to us. But a lot of them end up in the Ottoman Empire as well as in the land of Israel, right? There are a lot of economic opportunities. The culture is similar. The language is similar. The climate is similar. I'm not going to go from Cordoba or from Granada to Krakow. I'd much rather go to Istanbul. I'd much rather go, of course, to Jerusalem or to Tzfat, right? So that's really where our Jews are headed to. And in addition to all the other opportunities, the Turks give them a relative amount of autonomy in their own religious communities. So that's important to keep in mind as well. Okay, let's go to our other timeline here. Okay. So this is Tzfat People, Books and Songs. I just gave it a cute title, but it's useful to us to understand there are a few people in this list here who do not fit, right? Two of these people are not like the others. Okay. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is very much not fitting because he's in the wrong time period. Okay. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is in the second century. He's a Tana. And he is long, long, long before the major figures of Tzfat. Why do I put him in here? Because he is, well, first of all, the Ari Rav Yitzchak Luria sees himself as an incarnation of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. We're going to see the Ari believes in Gilgul Nishamot, right? An reincarnation of souls. And he believes that he is the Gilgul of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And more largely, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and the Zohar, which he is supposed to be the author of, right? And he probably is not, although many of the traditions may come from him. Okay? But his spirit kind of permeates 16th century Tzfat. So that's why he's in here. And we're going to talk about Meron. Okay? The other person who doesn't really fit is at the bottom is Rav Yitzchak Abuhav. He dies in Spain. And he never makes it to Tzfat, but we're going to talk about his synagogue, and that's why he comes in here. But the other people here, we'll just mention them and just take a look at the dates for a minute, because the dates are also important. We're a little bit out of order here, okay? Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, who's down here at the bottom, he is someone we're going to talk about next week when we talk about the Smicha controversy. It's very, very important. It really actually should go before the story of the Ari, because chronologically it's before, but I wanted us to get a sense of the kind of the atmosphere in Tzfat before we delve into the story of the Smicha controversy. But Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, great scholar, does this very radical attempt to renew Smicha. And like I said, we have no spoilers for next week. He has students, among them Rabbi Yosef Karo, okay, colleagues more than a student. Rabbi Yosef Karo, we are going to talk about, of course, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, but of many other halachic works as well. Okay. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, who is the dean of the Tzfat Kabbalists until the Ari comes along. A very, very important Kabbalist, but the Ari's ideas are so radical and different that Rabbi Moshe Cordovero kind of gets relegated a little bit to the side. The Ari, of course, we're going to talk about a lot. What you'll notice about him is his dates, right? He dies very young, okay? 1534 to 1572. So he's not even 40 years old when he dies. And he only lives in Tzfat for 2 years. Okay, it's incredible the impact that he has, but he's there for an incredibly, incredibly short time. And then we have a few others. Rabbi Chaim Vital is the major student of Rabbi Yitzchak Luria of the Ari. He's the main disseminator of the Ari's Torah. Rav Shlomo Alkobetz, because of course we have to talk about Lecha Dodi. And the Alshech, who is an important commentator on the Torah. We're not going to talk about him also, but just to take a look at this, right, at this list of luminaries in a very, very short time period, and you can already say, wow, this is a community that's going to produce something incredible, right? Whoever is not muted, please mute themselves. Okay, so let's understand a little where we are. I think we all know where Tzfat is, but always helpful to take a look at the map. Here is Tzfat up in the Upper Galilee. Right, literally high up. Why did Jews go here? And this is really a very good question, right? If you are making your way to the land of Israel and you believe that the Geula is on the way, right? The redemption is coming. Where are you going to go? You're going to go to Jerusalem. Are you going to stick yourself up in the gully? Oh, no, of course I'm going to go to Jerusalem. But they don't. Some of them do. And we're going to see the tension between Jerusalem and Tzfat next week, a little bit this week. But they don't really go to Jerusalem. They go up north. Why? A lot of reasons. Some of them very practical. Tzfat is on the trade route that's going up in the direction of Syria and the rest of the Ottoman Empire. So it's easier to make a living in Tzfat. Okay. The city itself is more economically based. So those are practical reasons. There's not a lot of threat from Christians, from Muslims. They're much less interested in Tzfat as opposed to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is economically very depressed. Plus, we're going to see there's this whole aura of the Galil, of the redemption, of Meron, right? Of the graves of the righteous and of various important Tanaim and Amoraim. And a lot of that is connected to this mystique of coming back and waiting for the redemption. So it's got lots of different reasons why they go there. Practical as well as more spiritual. Where are we going to go on our virtual trip today? Okay, so we are going to go, basically, this is not a map that's helpful in terms of understanding Tzfat. Anybody who's ever been to Tzfat knows that Tzfat is all on the mountain, right? Lots of steps all the time. This is hard to tell, but up here is the Mitsuda, is the fortress of Tzfat, and we're going to talk about this in a minute as kind of the beginnings of Tzfat, how the city grows, right? This is at the top of the hill, and the city basically grows out going downhill, right? And the streets that come out from around the fortress, okay? Today, the city is all Jewish, right? Up until 1948, there was an Arab section and a Jewish section. Up until 1948, this side was Arab, okay? And this side was Jewish, okay, more or less. 1948, as we'll see at the very end, it's conquered, taken by Israel, the whole city. And today, the area that was the Jewish area is the area of the synagogues. The area that was the Arab area is the area of the art quarter, the artisans quarter, right, where the artist galleries are. So that's what you have over here. And of course, going down the hill, you get to the cemetery and the mikvah and the Ari Sfaradi synagogue. And because of the earthquakes, the parts at the bottom of the hill down here are actually the most preserved, the oldest, right? The parts that really go back to the time of Golden Age of Tzfat is at the bottom of the hill. So all of those are important to understand as we go along. Okay. And one last thing, and I think I brought you guys this picture a different time, but it's just nice to see it because it's pretty, right? And we talk about this idea of the four holy cities, right? And people will give you all kinds of beautiful reasons for holy cities and connect them to the four elements in the Greek world, right? And this is always a nice thing to do as well, right? Earth, water, wind, and fire. Tveria, of course, is water. Jerusalem is fire, earth is Hebron, the graves, and wind or air is Tzfat, high up, very spiritual, very airy, okay? But when you look at these four cities, you say, okay, Jerusalem, I understand, Hebron, I understand, and the other two are a little more iffy in terms of a holy city. What does it mean? Tveria, okay, we have the Masorah, Tzfat, really? But the reason that they are the four holy cities is because these are the cities that Jews continued to live in, okay? Even when Jews were not living in Beit El or Shiloh or Shechem or wherever they continued in most situations to have communities in these cities, right? And that's where they get this designation of, you know, the four holy cities, and they are what were known to Jews in the Middle Ages and in the early modern period. Okay, one last little introductory piece, okay? One of the things that happens when the Jews move to the north, which happens already in the second century, Bar Kokhba revolt, when the Jewish population, there had been Jews in the north for a long time, but the center of Jewish population in the land of Israel moves to the north and stays that way. One of the things that happens is that traditions about where Bible stories happen also moved to the north, which is fascinating, right? Because they didn't happen in the north, but nobody knows so much about archaeology and they don't know about these places and they can't get to these places. So let's just move everything up north. So if you've ever wandered a lot around Sfat, you'd have to wander around a lot to see this. You may have come around upon a synagogue that is called Beit Knesset Shem Va'ever, right? Shem Va'ever, remember them, right? From the Torah, from Breishit, from the Midrash, right? Yaakov, when he runs away from Esav, last week's parsha, right, on his way to Lavan, according to the Midrash, he spends 20 years studying in the Beit Midrash of Shem Va'ever. Where is this Beit Midrash? Really, I could not tell you, but it's unlikely that it's in Sfat, right? It makes much more sense that it's somewhere near Beit El, where Yaakov has his dream. Well, the Crusaders, when they come to Sfat, they declare Sfat to be Beit El. They don't know where the real Beit El is. They're up here in Sfat. Let's make it Sfat, right? And it's a fascinating phenomenon. And the Jews take on this idea and make this Beit Knesset Shem Va'ever in Sfat, even though clearly it has nothing to do with Yaakov. And a lot of stories crossing the Jordan, right? The well of Miriam, all different kinds of stories get moved to Tzfat, even though they don't, to the north, excuse me, not only to Tzfat, but to the Galil, even though they don't belong there. Okay. The foundations of the city exists, but it's not particularly important until the Crusaders come. For the Crusaders, it's very important. Crusaders always like a place that's high up. They have a vantage point. They start to build an enormous fortress at the top of the hill. Its attitude started in the 1102. It's added to by the Templars. And once the Crusaders are kicked out by Baibars, he doesn't knock down the fortress. Remember from long ago, right? The beginning of the series, we talked about how Baibars destroys all the cities of the coast, but he doesn't destroy Sfat because Sfat is very useful to him. And he makes the fortress even bigger, right? If yours was big, mine is even bigger. And he creates this situation where Sfat becomes the largest fortress in the Middle East, which is kind of wild, right? There's very little left of it today. Today, you can go up to the top of the old city. You can see the Mitsuda Park, Gan HaMitsuda, and see what's left of the fortress. Not much, but it has had a great impact because the walls and the moats around the fortress are where the modern streets of the city are today. Okay. And the city grows out from the fortress. And that's really what creates the topography, the urban planning, and the architecture of today's city. Okay? Baibars comes in, he builds up the city a lot, he makes it an economic center, and that's really part of the reason why Jews are drawn to Sfat. We don't have so much left from the Mamluks, from the Mamluk period in Sfat. We have a few buildings here and there, but again, many things were destroyed. These are two buildings that are near the Rimonim Hotel, if you're familiar where that is, in the Artist Quarter. This one on the left here is a mausoleum from one of the leaders of Sfat, the Muslim rulers of Sfat from the 14th century. The building here on the right is called the Red Khan. It's an even older building. It's from the 13th century. It was a mosque. Then it was turned into a Khan, into like a traveler's motel. Today it's an event space, right? So we have a little bit left from the Mamluks, and these are very classic design elements of the Mamluks, the stripes here, the seashell designs, right? But we don't have so much left from their architecture. But they really lay the groundwork for the city of Sfat that becomes important in the time of the Ottomans. Okay, last little introductory piece, that's Mount Meron, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is very much a part of the story of Sfat, okay? Whether it's this idea of the Gilgul Neshamot, of the reincarnation, whether it's the idea of the mystical Torah that he is supposed to have learned with his son when he's in hiding in the cave, right? Remember the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? He's a fiery anti-Roman. He speaks out against the Romans, and then he has to go into hiding with his son, and they hide in a cave for 12 years, and they study Torah a whole time, right? And the idea is that the Torah that they're studying is very mystical. The Zohar appears much later in the Middle Ages. It's purported to be the work of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It is almost definitely not written down by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but by a Spanish Jewish Kabbalist. But it's very likely that these are much, much older traditions that were kind of underground and retained and studied by a select few and eventually written down. But the Jews who come to Tzfat are drawn to this idea of the Rashbi, right, of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, of his mystical Torah, of the other teachers that are around here. This is the grave, right, in Meiron. Unfortunately, very much in the news in the last year. But the idea of going, first of all, this grave is known before the time period of the mystics of Tzfat. It's known already by the 12th century. It's talked about travelers who come and they know that it's there. But the Ari in particular does a lot for the whole concept of Kivrei Tzadikim, right? The graves of the righteous and the importance of visiting the graves. He travels around the Galilee and he says, this is the grave of this one and this is the grave of that. And a lot of the Kivrei Tzadikim that people go to today are because the Ari said, this is the grave of Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair. And this is, right? And he went around and he identified them. Not the Rashbi, that was known already, but this whole idea is strengthened by the Ari. Now, about a 5-minute walk away from the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, there's an ancient synagogue. This is a great picture from the 19th century. This is a synagogue at the top of the hill. It always amuses me that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people will come to this grave that we don't really know if it's the right grave, but almost none of them will trek up the hill to see a synagogue that is way closer in time to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It's a little bit later. It's 3rd century. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is 2nd century, but still, it's pretty incredible that you have this ancient synagogue up here at the top of the hill. Already excavated in the early 20th century. We think it was built sometime in the middle of the 3rd century, destroyed in the earthquake of 363, but part of it is still standing, and it has a great tradition about it, perhaps connected to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and the mystics, which is that this lintel, which you can see in this old photograph, is already kind of getting ready to fall. The tradition is that once the lintel falls, that's when the Messiah is going to come. Sadly or not, this lintel has now been cemented in place so that it doesn't fall on anybody's head. What does that mean for the Mashiach? I really could not tell you. Okay, but it is right there. So you have Meiron, you have this tradition of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay, very, very important. But now let's get into Tzfat itself. Okay, so we are looking at a view of the cemetery. Cemetery of Tzfat is extraordinary, perhaps equaled only by the cemetery on Har HaZeitim, and perhaps even better because it wasn't ever desecrated like the Har HaZeitim cemetery was desecrated by the Jordanians. It's an incredibly powerful time capsule of this golden age of Tzfat. You go down there and you can see, and today the paths have been fixed up, but the graves are still the same graves. And you see graves of all of these greats who we just mentioned, you know, 20 minutes ago, we listed their graves are all there and they're all together. It's very unusual that there's so many real graves, right? And not graves that people thought this might be the place, but we actually have the headstone and we have the traditions about it. It's at the bottom of the city. So it was not as destroyed in the earthquakes. And next door to it is the Mikvah Ari, we're going to see, and the Beit Knesset Ari Hasparadi, which are the two most authentic connections that we have to the Ari in Tzfat of today. The modern cemetery of Tzfat, by the way, is right next door to the ancient cemetery. You can go from one to the other. So here you just take a look, right? Here we've got literally, you know, one step away from the other. We've got the Ari. We've got Rabbi Moshe Cordovera, this incredibly important Kabbalist. We've got Rav Shlomo Alkovitz, the author of the Lecha Dodi. We have Rav Moshe Mitrani, who we're going to talk about is one of the students of Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. We'll talk about him next week. Rabbi Yosef If Caro is right nearby, right? They're all here together and in death as they were in life. Okay? But obviously the one that is the most significant is the Ari or Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, right? Just to understand the acronym for a second, right? Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, where does Ari come in? Adonenu, our Lord, Rabbi Yitzchak, right? Adonenu, Rabbi Yitzchak, but the Ari, as in the lion, is also significant because his students were called the lion cubs, the Gurei Ha'ari, and it gives you a sense of kind of the importance of his personality. So the Ari is a fascinating figure. He's actually not one of the Spanish exiles. Okay? He's born in Jerusalem. Seems his father was even Ashkenazi, but his father dies when he's very young. If you go to Jerusalem, and maybe we'll take a look at it next week, you can see the Beit Knesset Ha'ari in Jerusalem, which is supposedly the place where the Ari was born. But his mother is widowed when he's very young. It's very hard for her to make a go of it. So she packs up her son and she goes to Egypt, where she has a wealthy uncle, Bezalel HaAshkenazi, hence we think that the Ari is not Sephardi, but Ashkenazi. And the Ari is brought up in Egypt, right? And very, very bright young man. And at an early age decides that he wants to start to study Kabbalah. There's a story that Rav Chaim Vital tells, which, whether it's true or not, I think is very much a window into this time period, which is that the Ari goes into a synagogue in Egypt and he sees one of these conversos, one of these Jews who had just recently escaped from Spain or from Portugal, one of the crypto Jews, but he doesn't know anything, right? And he's actually holding the book that he thinks is a Siddur upside down. And he goes up to the Ari and he says, could you show me? I don't know what to do. And the Ari takes the book from him and it's not a Siddur, it's not a prayer book, but it's a Zohar. And that's how he starts to study mysticism. Is it true or not? I don't know. But it gives us this connection between the mystical Torah, the time period of the conversos, the Ari, and it's very powerful. He begins to study mysticism, and he understands that just like you're not going to be a movie star by staying in Montana, you got to move to Hollywood. He's got to get out of Egypt and he's got to go to Tzfat. And that's what he does. And he picks himself up. And again, he's very young still. He's in his 30s and he makes his way to Tzfat. And he revolutionizes the study of Kabbalah and the town and everything in a very short time period. So there's a lot of Torah to the Ari. Most of it, I will say very clearly, I do not understand, but I think there are some ideas that we can get a sense of and that are very important. So I brought you a picture here of the Sfirot in Kabbalah, right? The emanations, let's say, of God, right? That God starts out, right, very, very far away from us, very transcendent, but comes closer to us, more imminent, right? How can we explain? How can God be both Avinu and Malkeinu, right? This is one of the attempts to explain that there are different emanations of God that come closer and closer and closer to us. And this is a very old idea in Kabbalah. What does the Ari do with it that is revolutionary? Okay, he talks about how does God create the world? Right. And there are two ideas here that are important. And in both of them, at least according to Gershom Shalom, you can see the impact of this story of the expulsion. Right. First of all, how does God create the world? God is everywhere. How can he create a world? He fills everything. And so the Kabbalah, Lurianic Kabbalah, talks about something called Tzimtzum. Right. God has to retract himself, has to pull himself away from a portion of the universe so that he can create the world. In essence, God has to exile himself from a bit of the universe in order to create the world, right? Which is an amazing idea, right? That the world begins with an act of exile, right? That's exactly what these Spanish Jews are thinking about. The other idea, and this is a complex idea, but it's one that has been translated into very simple terms and is very, very powerful, is that when God creates the world, he has to take his divine light and pour it into the Sfirot that will eventually come down to the world. The first three, the upper Sfirot are able to contain the divine light. The bottom are not able to, and they break and they shatter. And these sparks of the divine light get trapped inside the vessels of the Sfirot and they descend down into the depths. What happens? They're in these Klipot. You have divine light that is in exile. Right? Again, exile. And you have to get it out. You have to take these sparks and lift them up out of the darkness, out of the exile, and bring them back to God, right? Obviously, this is all not talking on a, you know, an everyday practical level, but there is a very practical meaning to it. How do you do that? Every time a Jew does one of the commandments, he has lifted up a piece of this divine light and brought it back up to God. When all of the sparks have been brought back, that's when Mashiach is going to come. Now think about that idea. That's an unbelievably powerful idea. What that means is I don't have to be a genius. I don't have to be the greatest tzaddik in the world. I just have to be me, but do one thing plus one thing plus one thing. And each of those things is bringing the Messiah closer, right? And the example I always give for this, and it's a very powerful example. If you've ever walked down the street, right? If you're a man and you're approached by a Chabadnik and he says, have you put on tefillin today? Right? And if you're a woman and it's a Thursday or a Friday, he says, do you want to light Shabbat candles this week? Now, obviously they want you to light Shabbat candles every week. They want you to put on tefillin every day. However, even doing it once is enough to lift up a spark, and it has significance in and of itself. And this is an idea that is so powerful that it reverberates down through the centuries, through, in a bad way, through Sabbateanism, in a good way, through Chassidut, until today. So this is one of the major impacts that the Ari has on the Jewish world. We'll come back to a few others. Let's talk for a minute about Rav Yosef Karo, okay, whose grave is also down here. Rav Yosef Karo, despite his hope that he would one day be a martyr, actually lives a very long life. He's born in Spain. He's 4 years old when his family has to leave. First they go to Portugal, then they go to Turkey. He grows up as a brilliant, brilliant young man in Turkey. He's a brilliant legal scholar. He writes a commentary, the Beit Yosef, on the Arba Turim, on this post Maimonidean, a different code, right? The tour. But he wants more than anything not to be a halachist, but to be a mystic. And he makes his way to Tzfat, comes to Tzfat in 1535. He becomes very connected to Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, like we mentioned before. He studies Torah. He believes that he hears Torah from an angel that he calls the Magid Mishnah, right? But his greatest work is not a work of mysticism, but a work of law, and we all know it, and it's the Shulchan Aruch, right? The Shulchan Aruch is the first Judaism for Dummies book, okay? Basically, what he does is he takes his enormous codex of the Beit Yosef on the enormous Book of the Torah and the enormous Rambam, and he writes a very simple how to do Judaism book, right? All about the very practical. He doesn't talk about the temple and he doesn't talk about sacrifices. Practical, right? This is what we do for prayer. This is what we do for holidays. This is what we do in business. This is what we do in Shabbat, right? And very, very practical. Shulchan Aruch, it's the set table, right? It's ready for everybody to sit down and to eat. Eventually, the Rama Rav Moshe Isterlis, who's a contemporary, but in Poland, adds in his notes the mapa. He places the tablecloth on the table so that we have the Ashkenazi and the Sephardi, and it becomes the code book, the halachic code book for forever. This is the synagogue that is called the Rabbi Yosef Karo Synagogue. It is not from the time of Rabbi Yosef Karo, right? Whatever building was there was destroyed in the earthquake. However, underneath the synagogue, where today there is a Beit Midrash, there was a Beit Midrash then, and we think it was actually the original Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yosef Karo, where he says he received these messages from this Magid Mishnah, from this divine emissary. The synagogue today is beautiful, one of the beautiful synagogues in Tzfat. The library, you can see in the back, there's like this great bookcase with very old books. This was the library of Rabbi Ben Shimon, who was the chief rabbi of Tzfat up until 1948. Today, his grandson is the gabbai of the shul. All right, let's go back down the hill. Right near the cemetery are two structures that go back to 16th century Tzfat. And one of them, the men here may be familiar with, the women much less. This is the mikvah of the Ari. Okay, no entrance to ladies, and you really don't want to go in. Very much naked men. But but it's a fascinating place, right? It's a natural spring. And the tradition is that this is where the Ari would go to immerse himself. And the story that is told is that he said to his students, when I die, bring my body to the mikveh and leave me there. I will immerse myself. Does he not? I do not know. Okay. Next door is a little bit up the hill, slightly up the hill, is a synagogue that is the only synagogue that goes back to this time period, meaning the complete, you know, building. It's the oldest synagogue in Tzfat. It goes back not to the Ari, but earlier. It goes back to Mamluk times. At that time, it was called the Eliyahu Hanavi Synagogue. Today, it's called the Ari Sfaradi. There are two Ari synagogues in Tzfat. The tradition is that the Ari and the Eliyahu Hanavi would sit in a little cave on the side and they would learn Torah. And it's a beautiful synagogue. It's not visited so often because it's not like on the main drag there, but it really is the one that goes back to this time period as opposed to the others, which are all rebuilt post the 1830 earthquake, including this one, right? And this is the more famous one, the Ari Ashkenazi. This is a synagogue that's post the Ari. The tradition is that right outside was where the Ari and his students would go out to the hills to do Kabbalat Shabbat in their white robes. And this is where it's a good place to talk about how does the Ari influence Judaism, right? So we have this idea that we said everyone can bring redemption, which is a very important and very powerful idea. We have this idea that the Messiah is on the way any moment now, right? We have a famous story about the Ari where Friday afternoon, he says to his students, we're going to Jerusalem for Shabbat, right? Friday afternoon from Tzfat to Jerusalem in the days before you have cars, right? Even today, I wouldn't leave from Tzfat to Jerusalem on a Friday afternoon. But the Ari says, we're going to Jerusalem for Shabbat. And his students are a little hesitant, but they say, well, let us just go tell our wives. And he said, if you hadn't said that, the Messiah would have come, right? This feeling that the Mashiach can come at any moment, you have to be prepared, you have to be ready, right? We talked about graves and the importance of visiting graves and this idea of the Gilgul of Nishamot, that everybody is an incarnation of a soul before them and your goal is to perfect that soul and you keep being, the soul keeps being reborn until it's perfected. And another beautiful idea is nature as a microcosm of the universe, right? And that brings us to practices that we have from Tzfat, one of which is the Seder Tu Bishvat, which has become more and more popular in recent years, right? That you look at the fruit and the peels on the fruit and the seeds and how does it reflect kind of God in the world, right? And what's the external and what's the internal? Tu Bishvat Seder comes from Tzfat. Staying up all night and learning on Shavuot, Tikkun Leil Shavuot comes from Tzfat. Kabbalat Shabbat, of course, the Lecha Dodi, the going out to the fields, comes from Tzfat. Yom Kippur Katan, fasting, Erev Rosh Chodesh, comes from Tzfat, right? All of these ideas very much connected to this concept that the world is on the cusp of redemption, and we just have to push it a little further, right? And you can understand why this is such an appealing idea to the Spanish Jewish exiles who are coming here and are so ready for redemption. And what can we do to bring it further? And like I said, this is a story that's going to continue next week as well. We talk about the Smicha controversy. Just one more shul that you can't pass over, and that's the shul of the Abohav. Rav Yitzchak Abohav, the Menorat HaMaor, he was a mystic, a Spanish Jewish mystic, who lives in Spain, who dies in Spain, whose synagogue is in Spain, in Toledo. He never comes to Tzfat, and he's not exiled from Spain either, right? He's around earlier. Why does he have a synagogue in Tzfat? So that, of course, is a very Tzfat story. That one night the Abohav comes in a dream to one of the rabbis of 16th century Tzfat, and he says, my synagogue has been turned into a church, right? A fate that we know happened to, unfortunately, many synagogues in Spain and in Portugal. And I want you to, it's very painful to me that the place where I learned and where I prayed and where I taught is now a church. I want you to bring it to Tzfat. And the rabbi says, well, how am I going to bring it to Tzfat? He said, ah, you rabbis in Tzfat, you get together, you'll pray, you'll bring it to Tzfat. And the story goes that he gathers together all the rabbis and they pray. And here we go, Wizard of Oz. The next morning, the synagogue shows up. Okay, it's a good Tzfat story. However, this is the inside. It's definitely the most beautiful synagogue in Tzfat. However, there is a kernel in the story that is very true. And that is inside the Aron, there are three Aronot Kodesh. There are three holy arks in the Abohav synagogue. And inside one of them is a Sefer Torah that goes back to 14th century Spain. Okay, 14th century Spain, and the tradition is, and it's very likely that it's true, that this is the Abu Hafs Sefer Torah that the exiles took with them and managed to bring them. It's actually still a kosher Sefer Torah, despite its great age. It's only brought out 3 times a year, the initials of Kasher, Kippur, Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, and it's still in use. Okay, let's talk a little about the Beit HaKahal. Now, let's talk about the life of 16th century Tzfat. So some people here may be familiar with Livnot Lehibanot. It's an amazing program for students to come to Israel to study about Judaism in Israel, but they also do very practical work. They create parks and they refurbish old people's homes. They do all kinds of things. And their center is in Tzfat. And they bought a property a few years ago because they needed more space than what they had. And before they could build, they had to excavate. And when they excavated, they discovered that their property was sitting on the remains of what was probably the community center of 16th century Tzfat, which is astounding. And they discovered mikvaot, which is what you see a mikvah on the left here. They discovered a bakery. They discovered all different kinds of rooms. And we think that this was the community center of the golden age of Tzfat. And it's a good place for us to talk for a minute about what was this community like, right? So from our sources that we have, from people who write about this time period, this is a very holy community. You have all kinds of societies. You have societies that get together in the middle of the night to do what's called tikkun chatzot, right? Special prayers where you cry over the destruction of the temple and you pray for the Messiah to come. There's a lot of chesed, right? There's a lot of good deeds that are done, all these different kinds of societies to help the widows and the orphans, et cetera, et cetera. But there are also things that are very unusual. They have public gatherings where they confess their sins, right? And this idea that we've done something wrong and we need to be punished, and only then can the Messiah come. We're going to talk about that next week with the Smicha controversy. This is a very holy community that believes that the redemption is around the corner. It is constantly engaged in tikkun, right? In tikkun, not in the super liberal sense of tikkun olam, right? Going to help poor people in Africa, but tikkun of my soul, of the Jewish people, of our relationship with God. This is what they are doing all the time. I'm going to bring the stuff that I have here about the Lecha Dodi next time, because it's very connected to our story of Smicha. But I do want to bring us a little bit into the modern era of Tzfat, if we're already in Tzfat. So the Ottomans rule in Tzfat. Again, earthquakes plague the city in the 1600s, in the 1700s. The city is at a certain point, the Jewish community leaves because things are just too difficult, but then they eventually come back. This is the government building, the Saraya, that's built in the 18th century when Tzfat starts to kind of come back to itself. Jews start to return. There's another great crisis in 1837 with the terrible earthquake then. But the Ashkenazi Jews who start to come back in the 19th century, the students of the Vilna Gaon who eventually will go to Jerusalem, first they come to Tzfat. So Tzfat remains a center, even if it has a gap, a time period where it's not an important Jewish community. By the 20th century, lots of tension between the Jews and the Arabs and between both of them and the British. And if you've ever been to Tzfat, you will recall this staircase, perhaps not so happily, as you trek up it many, many, many stairs to get to your lunch. Okay. But this staircase is very important, not just as a way to get around Tzfat, but the British actually put it in as a physical separation between the Jewish quarter and the Arab quarter, right? Because of all the tensions that are going on between the Jews and the Arabs. In 1948, okay, and if you have any kind of picture in your head of the partition plan, the Galil was going to be divided between the Jews and the Arabs. In 1948, there are 12,000 Arabs in Tzfat. There are 1,200 Jews in Tzfat. It was not at all clear that Tzfat was going to remain in Jewish hands. The British evacuate in April. They pressure the Jews to evacuate, but the Jews stay on. This is one of the monuments above the old city. This is a monument to the Davidka, which is this very, very Jewish weapon developed in 1948 when we had no weapons. It's a weapon that makes a lot of noise, but does barely any damage, but the Arabs didn't know that. And it's one of the reasons we were able to keep Sfat. There was this feeling that the Jews are invincible and the Jews have all this power and the Jews are, you know, sending bombs. The Jews had nothing, right? But yet there was this sense that the Jews are very, very strong and the Arabs were frightened. Ultimately, the community takes up arms, but not a very powerful community. The Palmach ends up arriving, right? They arrive after the British evacuate. They come in May, and we have this great quote from the elders of Sfat, right? Sfat was saved by an action and by a miracle. The action was the Jews gathering to pray. The miracle was the arrival of the Palmach. Ultimately, May 10th, the Jews take Sfat, the Arabs flee, and it becomes a completely Jewish city. And like I said, we're going to come back to the story of Sfat, but I just wanted to end with a little bit about modern Sfat, which today is a very interesting place. A lot of seekers, a lot of searchers, a lot of artists. Israel, the state of Israel in the 50s, actually brought artists because they wanted there to be an artist colony in Sfat. Today, artists come of their own accord because of, you know, the reputation and the beauty and everything else. It's a complicated place. It's got all different kinds of Hasidut, Chabad, and Breslov, and not everybody gets along with everybody else. But there are a lot of fascinating things there, including artists who work really in the themes of Kabbalah, right? And that's what you're seeing here. An incredibly beautiful women's mikvah that does a lot to teach about mikvah education and Judaism's attitude towards family purity and sexuality. And of course, Sfat candles, which is just a lot of fun. So like I said, I'm not cheating you out of L'cha Dodi. We will come back to it next week. But let's take a look and see comments that people have. Ooh, let's go. Okay. Wealthiest, right. Okay, Jews, they try to avoid Catholic areas because of the Inquisition. Yes, of course, right? We want to stay away from anywhere that the Inquisition is going to come after us. And Holland is not so simple and England is not so simple, but exactly, as Irene says, you want to stay away from the Catholics as much as you can. Okay. How many people went anywhere is a great question that is very, very difficult to answer, right? If we want to talk about numbers, right, we say Sfat in 16th century at its height is about 10,000 people, which is actually really large. Jewish community of Jerusalem is much, much smaller. But how many total immigrants? I cannot give you an answer. Okay, the false prophets, the false messiahs is going to be the next stage, right? That's our last class. It's affected by this Lurianic Kabbalah, but they take it in a very twisted direction, right? And that's already the 17th century, all right? 1600s, 1700s. Hey, how did the Ari die? How did lots of people die in those days, right? You got a toothache. I don't think we know how he died. There might be some story in one of these hagiographies, but I am not familiar with it. Why the Jews go so many places? They go wherever they can go, right? Wherever you can go, wherever anyone's going to let you in, that's where you're going to go. You're right that groups do come, right? And we have this concept, to use an anachronistic term, of, you know, Landsmannschaften, right? This one went and I'm going to come and he's set the first generation and I'm going to be the next generation that's going to come after him. But still, They did separate because they were all looking for places to go. Okay. The fortress was built by the Crusaders. It's added to by the Mamluks, and only very little bits of it survive. There's very little. It looks good in that picture. When you go in real life, it doesn't look like much of anything. Okay. The grave is outside the city, but it's really on the very edge of the city. Okay. The remains of the cemetery do not end up because of the earthquake. There probably were things that fell down to the cemetery, but the cemetery is around already much earlier. Right. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai does the planting the plant on human remains, right? And he is the mystical guy, right? So it's mystical and natural, but nice, nice connection. The Ari create this philosophy out of thin air. Is it a Jewish idea? Ooh, that's a very interesting way of putting the question. The Ari, of course, would tell you these are, you know, mystical ideas that are already present. They're present in the Zohar. They're present earlier. But there's clearly creativity going on, right? There's clearly different ideas, creativity. That is it going against traditional Judaism? I'm not so sure, but there's always innovation. Chassidut is also innovation. Thank you, Rivka Esther. Yes, the blue is very beautiful. One of those Sfat synagogues has a Sefer Torah that is an expulsion survivor. I did not know that. Thank you, Susanna. That's the Abu Hav. Oh, I thought you were talking about, I don't know why, sorry. I thought you meant Holocaust. No, that's the Abu Hav. That's what's still in use. Ari is Jewish, guilt trip. Okay, I don't know what that means. The engineer who invented the Davidka is a fascinating story. The Palmach acted when they got there. Yes, there's very cool. No, this Palmach definitely did things, but this was the approach of the Ziknei Tzfat. The Rashbi's cave is in Pikiin, which is not far from Tzfat. Again, it's an old tradition. Is it true? Who knows? Irene's daughter is an artist in Tzfat. Tell us who she is, Irene. Who's your daughter?
I mean, she's not anyone famous. She only just went there, but she's doing some illustration of the Ish Ben Chai with a rabbi.
The Ben Ish Chai. Oh, so cool.
Yeah, I know. Yes. I mean, I really love this talk, you know, because I have visited before she made Aliyah, and it's just brought it to life. I do think you're brilliant, especially as it's my field, and you're just so marvelous with all the maps and everything. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. All right. So next week is basically Tzfat part two. It's not going to be Tzfat, but it is going to be the story of the Smicha controversy, the attempts at redemption, and of course, one of the greatest Jewish women of all time, Dona Gracia. Can't miss her. She's amazing. So see you all next week. Shabbat shalom. Maxine, do you want to do coming attractions?
Sure. Thank you, Shuli. I hope you'll all join again next week, same time, anywhere you can get an internet connection. And tonight we have a shiur on the Parshat Hashvua. Rabbi Yoel Finkelstein is teaching. And again, tomorrow morning, Rabbi Talman gives his shiur on the Siddur. Following that, next week starts again with Rabbi Liebtag teaching on Shemitah and theme of seven in the Tanakh. So hope you'll join again. Thank you so much, and Shabbat Shalom.